Off the ball.
Rugby.
Sevens was for your early 20s.
Were you ever tempted?
Couldn't have thought of anything worse. First of all, my engine was not my strong point. It would have had to be in those very early years.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Rugby on Off the Ball.
You are very welcome along. Now, Catherine Dane is an Irish rugby player, a physiotherapist, a PhD candidate, and a coach. And I'm delighted to say that she is with us here in studio. Catherine, I usually am very thankful for anybody giving up their time to be with us here in studio. I'm especially thankful that you've taken some time out to be here with us. A lot going on at the moment, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, I've been all over the place at the moment. Very lucky that my PhD has taken me to Monaco, to Sydney and Melbourne for presentations, a bit of collaboration and a bit of holiday mixed in there as well. So been really enjoying myself.
The trip looked fascinating, but the research is the thing I want to talk to you about. Can you talk us through what you're a PhD candidate in?
Yeah, so I'm doing my PhD out of Trinity, specifically looking at tackle safety and performance in women's rugby union. I think that it's an area that's been underrepresented in the research space. We've got loads of tackle research in men's rugby that's been used to inform tackle law changes and coaching resources, but there really wasn't anything in place when I started my PhD 4 years ago. So I thought, oh, better give this a look, given my own playing career and the knowledge that, yeah, the playing contexts are quite different. I thought it was quite important to have a look at this.
What was the initial difference when you analysed the measures that are in place, for example, in the men's game and the women's game?
So I started off just with a scope and review of the evidence. There was very, very little research out there. Then I went on to do qualitative interviews with players to kind of capture their experiences of tackle safety and performance. And what struck me was that there was a lot of challenges within the performance context, especially relating to like a lack of resources, kind of disparities in the level of coaching that they were getting as well. Tackling was kind of regarded as a bit of an afterthought. And
right.
there were some players that had kind of played their first game of rugby before even being introduced to tackling in training, which
right.
is quite frightening and obviously not very conducive to safe tackling in the game. So that led to a lot of injuries and a lot of fears and lack of confidence in their tackling ability.
Are we talking senior players here that had been playing before getting a proper breakdown of how to tackle?
Yeah, these are women of 18 years and above, from community level game to university, professional, elite internationals. There were one or two players that played their first game of international sevens before ever making a tackle.
No way.
Yep.
That's extraordinary. I dare say if you said that to any man who's been playing rugby all the way up through the ranks, they would find that absolutely incredible that there couldn't be a detailed instruction. And it's pretty obvious why that is, but you've obviously got a lot more detail on the safety aspect of why teaching people to tackle properly is so important.
It's a really complex skill and there's lots involved. I don't know if you've ever played rugby before or tackled anyone?
Yeah, very, very little.
There's loads involved. I mean, there's technical skills, there's tactical decision making, there's psychological processes and just like physical robustness as well. Like, how do we make sure that players are equipped to do all that and prepared to execute it safely and effectively when it comes to match day?
What is the one thing that people are doing wrong when it comes to tackling them when you're looking at these people who've been playing rugby and have not been taught properly how to tackle? Is there a common error that they're making?
A common error? Oh, there's so many different things involved. We, in research terms, we split the tackle into pre-contact, contact and post-contact. And particularly in the women's game, in the pre-contact phase, we would find that they just don't really quite get their footwork right coming into contact, which means that they're exposed maybe. They're not making initial contact with their shoulder. They're maybe using their torso, which is then putting them in closer proximity to their head, getting initial contact. When it comes to the contact themselves, we find that lack of proper wrap on the ball carrier gets in place, and then you have your tackle breaks and offloads and things like that. So combination of pre-contact, getting their tackle height down as well, and making the right initial contact is probably some of the key areas that it needs working on.
Which leads to, I presume, dangerous contact in a number of situations.
Yeah, we want to try and mitigate as many head contacts as possible in the women's game. I'm sure you've seen the instrumented mouth guards and the tackle height law changes in an effort to try and reduce the space between the ball carrier's head and the tackler. So similarly for the tackler itself, it's trying to get yourself into a safer zone that you can keep your head out of the way and make initial contact with the shoulder.
When you're watching Ireland play in the Women's Six Nations, and obviously from your own experience of having played with the team yourself, are you seeing at that level even a difference in tackle technique and tackle standard compared to the men's game, or is that level of the game okay?
I think it's definitely improving. In terms of the technical characteristics of the tackle, it's probably a little bit different between the men's game, but tactically, I've been really impressed with the way in which they're tackling. They're using a kind of double tackle technique where somebody goes low, somebody else goes high and tries to trap the ball. And I think we're seeing lots of dominant tackles. And I'm sure you've seen Niamh Jones tackling in the Women's Six Nations. Like that's textbook tackle technique. And any man that plays rugby will say, geez, that's out of this world. Really, really good technique. So the gap's definitely closing. But we've players like Niamh Jones and Aoife Wafer that are, you know, heads above everyone else.
And what have they done, or what has their experience been that sets them apart, do you think?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think Niamh's story was that her dad taught her tackling back in the day. She's been playing mini rugby from a very young level, and playing with the boys from that age probably gave her a lot of the grounding and the foundations of tackling, the kind of physical requirements. She probably is quite fearless as well, and that psychological component of, oh, I'm not going to be very good at this, has been probably knocked out of her because, you know, she's been playing with the boys. I had a similar experience growing up where I played with the under-8 boys until there was a females team available. So it definitely, it's kind of a fight or flight. You have to do it, and it gives you a lot of exposure, maybe in comparison to women who start playing rugby in adulthood.
Is that the way it should be? Do you think that people should be playing with the boys at under-8 and then obviously in their teens to split up?
Yeah, it's kind of controversial because there's lots of youth girls teams coming up now, and that's really, really brilliant, and it gives girls an opportunity to play. Perhaps girls that don't want to play with boys at that level. But I think for the skill of tackling and for actually the basic fundamentals of rugby skills, playing mixed rugby for as long as possible is a really, really good thing. We see it in other sports as well, and it can only be the same for rugby.
On the other sports thing, it's very interesting because obviously you spent some time down in Australia looking at AFL teams, rugby league teams. Rugby is often used as a sort of conversation point when we watch the NFL here, even where it's like, why did the NFL lads try and tackle the way they do when they could just rugby tackle somebody? It seems to make a lot more sense. But you've obviously compared the tackle technique from other sports to rugby. How do rugby players, rugby union players that is, compare in terms of their standard when it comes to the tackle?
I would say rugby union in comparison to say NFL or AFL, they have a lot more standardized tackle technique of kind of, this is what you do pre-contact, this is what you're doing in contact, and this is what like a good tackle looks like. But I would argue that it really depends on the context of the tackle itself and the situation that you find yourself in. I mean, Niamh Jones making a tackle in the middle of the pitch is going to look very different to Bevan Parsons making a tackle on the edge that maybe she's got 10, 15 metres to try and cover. So each tackle looks different. But I think when you compare rugby league to rugby union, it's a totally different tackle.
Yeah.
Again, which makes things like transitioning from one code to the other very, very difficult. The rugby league tackle is quite upright, and there's 2 or 3 defenders involved generally in most of those tackles. And my understanding of it is that it's upright so as to absorb the force of the ball carrier. And because there's no rucks, you have to try and slow that process of, you know, trapping them first and getting to ground. And there's a bit of a ground wrestle that goes on to try and like gain as many seconds as possible so that your team can get back whatever the 10 metres and come up again as a defensive line. So there's lots of different tactical components at play with the rugby league tackle.
Did I read as well in your research and the work that you've been doing that the highest percentage of injuries can actually be attributed to what happens to the tackler?
Yeah. It appears in the women's game anyway that seems to be the case. It can be a combination of lots of different things like poor tackle technique or physical differences or when fatigue starts to creep into things as well. But we just haven't really got enough of the research yet to kind of ascertain where are we going to best target that and mitigate those injuries to the tackler.
If you had to pick one thing that shocked you or surprised you during your trip or during the last few months of research, what is it?
That shocked me. That's a good question. I should have prepared for that. I was shocked by the the amount of energy and momentum that there is in sport and in media and research and all sort of spheres of sport for the women's game, and there's a lot of encouragement and a lot of like momentum in this space. I was at the International Olympic Consensus conference on injury prevention in sport, and I was presenting some of my qualitative research there, and it seemed like every other talk was about women's sport, which is absolutely brilliant. It's a key kind of priority in their research agendas, and yeah, it's really good. I felt like really energized after those conferences and visits. It seems like there's a lot of momentum in this space, so good vibes.
Absolutely. So the academic space is really making strides when it comes to the women's game, and it's all games really, it's not just rugby, right?
Yeah, absolutely. All sports and para sports and all the whole spectrum of sports in that area. So it's now hoping that the good research that is being done is slowly going to get implemented into our coaching practices and our policies and rule changes and things.
Brilliant. Catherine, can I ask you how the health is nowadays? And you might bring us back to November 22, because it's been a hell of an 18 months for you.
Yeah, crazy 18 months. I can't believe it's been 18 months, actually. Yeah, I'm doing really, really well. I'm flying it. I'm probably the fittest and strongest that I've been ever before, because I've had this time to kind of prioritise gym and rugby conditioning and all the lovely stuff that I've normally been putting on the back burner before as a scrum half and getting away with it. But yeah, I'm doing really well. Thank you.
Can you take us back to November 22 for anybody who's listening who isn't familiar with your story?
Yeah, sure. So November 2022, I had just come back from presenting my research at a World Rugby conference in Amsterdam. I was in Cape Town the month before that presenting research, and I'd signed a contract with Ireland Women's Rugby. It was kind of the first kind of cohort of players to sign a contract. So I felt on top of the world, absolutely privileged. And I was unfortunately rehabbing an ACL injury that had happened in the summer of that year. I was doing hip thrusts in the gym, and I suddenly got a big headache, and it turned out that I'd suffered a brain hemorrhage on the gym floor.
How soon after that pain do you realise what's after happening, or what are the sequence of events in the minutes afterwards?
Yeah, so I had this massive headache as I was doing my hip thrusts. Luckily, I had my S&C coach, Ed Slattery, in front of me. He saw immediately that I was in distress. He saw that my face had dropped and I had complete loss of power on my left arm and left leg. I couldn't get over how quickly things happened. I was also very lucky that the men's 15s team doctor, Kieran Cosgrove, was at the pull-up bar behind me. So Ed got Kieran immediately, and I think I was in Connolly Hospital within about 15 minutes.
Right.
So it all happened very, very quick. I remember thinking at the time, oh gosh, I think this is a stroke. I had worked on a stroke ward before in Donnybrook Hospital, so I kind of knew some of the signs and symptoms, but I hadn't worked with somebody in the real acute stages like this, so it was quite frightening. But weirdly enough, I tried to use a bit of humour to dissipate the kind of tension and chaos that was happening in that situation.
How do you mean?
I think it's really embarrassing, but I said to Kieran, the team doctor, "Oh gosh, this will make for a really interesting case study, won't it, Kieran?" Like, I don't know where my head was, but you were just in such a fight or flight, pure trauma experience, and that was how I responded, was through humour and trying to look on the bright side.
Did you know what it was as soon as you felt the sensation, or pretty much a couple of seconds after that?
Yeah, I suppose I did. I felt blood kind of behind my right eye, which is crazy. And that was where the AVM was. And an AVM is an arteriovenous malformation. It was the little cluster of blood vessels that decided to burst that day. I had been born with it, but I'd never had any symptoms or anything preceding that event. So, I suppose I had a fair idea, but I wasn't quite sure exactly the severity of the situation. Or I felt good, but I was obviously very, very unwell at that moment.
Of course. Do you remember everything that happens then in terms of being transported to Connolly Hospital in the next couple of hours, or what's your consciousness like at that time?
Yeah, I was fully conscious. Fully conscious, probably not feeling very at myself. I had very, very low blood pressure. I think that's how the body responds when there's a bleed anywhere, your blood pressure drops. So I couldn't really move. I had no power in my in my left arm and leg, and my speech was slurred, which was interesting and embarrassing. But my friend from Dublin, Sarah, she kindly came across town to see me, and my parents are from up north in Fermanagh, so they had to come down the road 2 and a bit hours to come see me. So I felt very fortunate that I was surrounded by really good healthcare and good friends and stuff at that moment. But it's all a bit of a blur, to be honest.
How dangerous is the situation when you look back on it now, in terms of what you're being told at the time, in terms of what your parents and your friend is being told at the time, in terms of the severity of your own condition at that moment?
Yeah, I suppose I haven't really considered how severe it was. I do have to say I was massively lucky that it happened where it happened. I don't think if I had made it to Connolly in that short space of time and got the care that I needed, that I would have made this really good recovery. So I count my blessings every day that I'm as good as I am.
And to be in a room with a doctor there at that moment, it's almost ideal situation insofar as there can be any ideal situation for this to happen. It's obviously horrendous, but yeah, to be in that high performance setup essentially,
yeah,
when that happens, it's that is the one lucky element in a very, very unlucky moment.
Absolutely. Yeah, I live with Jenny Murphy.
Right.
You know Jenny, and I dropped her off to the airport at like 6 a.m. the previous morning. So I was alone in a fourth floor apartment in Smithfield. If it had happened in my sleep or anywhere else, like, God knows what would happen. So yeah, I was just absolutely right place, right time.
What happens in the days and weeks after it?
The days and weeks, I think I spent about 2 weeks in Beaumont Hospital, got transferred from Connolly to Beaumont. That was where they performed, it's kind of like a gluing surgery to try and glue up the burst vessels. There was lots of scans and things, and I was very determined to get home as quick as I could. Being a 26-year-old in a ward of older people that have just had strokes and things was really horrible. It was not great experience. Now they gave me the best care in the world, but I didn't want to find myself from going from Irish rugby gym floor to Beaumont Hospital was a horrible shock to the system. So I was keen to get home as quick as possible, and I was very lucky that my parents had the best setup for me, and I was able to access kind of community supports back home in Fermanagh. They have like brain injury services and all sorts of things to make sure that I've got kind of all the help I need in terms of psychology, occupational therapy, and like there's lots of stuff that happens to somebody after a stroke. So it's a real holistic care model. So I was glad that all of that was really facilitated for me.
When it comes to the holistic element to all of that, is there any part of the things that you needed to do in terms of your recovery that you found the hardest, or was there any element of it that you struggled with at that time?
I have to say it was different from any other injury. I think when you know when it's an MSK injury, like a calf tear or something, you know the steps in the process, and you know, okay, I've got, you know, 5-6 weeks of this, and I can do, you know, I'll progress. Whereas with a brain injury, it's there's no real timeline, and nobody's got the cheat codes to help you navigate the system. I think the psychological element was probably the biggest hurdle for me. Was getting over like what happened. I think as athletes, we try and blaze through tough patches. You know, we've been through highs and lows as an Irish team over the years, you know, not qualifying for that World Cup and things. And I got over that pretty well. I was able to compartmentalise those feelings into a box and, you know, do the Autumn Internationals after that and keep going. Whereas this brain injury definitely just stops you in your tracks, stops you dead, and you have to actually give it the attention it needs. And I think that's where the psychological help was probably the biggest factor in my recovery, to be honest.
It's just a pure sort of, is it a loneliness? It's just me dealing with this? I know you make the comparison with the Rugby World Cup thing there. You have a whole squad of people around you, I guess, who are going through the exact same feeling. Is it the solo nature of it all that makes it extra tough?
Yeah, it is. It is really, really solo. And nobody quite understands what way you're feeling either. Like, people have had concussions and stuff, and I'd say it's like a very severe concussion is probably the way you feel for, probably felt like that for good 8 months or so afterwards. And people, you know, they try really, really hard to cheer you up and stuff. But ultimately, I had a lot of work to do to try and come to terms with what had happened. And you feel a lot of anger towards, like, oh, I'm 26. Like, this shouldn't happen to a 26-year-old. But in hindsight and looking back, I actually think, wow, it's probably one of the best things that really happened to me, in terms of giving me a lot of, I have a lot more gratitude and a lot more better outlook on life, in terms of kind of living and being as present as possible and living to the max. So I wouldn't be in, I don't think I would have been in Monaco and Sydney and Melbourne if it hadn't happened to me. And I've made some amazing connections and amazing collaborations over the 18 months right. that I've had, that I probably wouldn't have had before. So it's all good.
How long does it take for that mentality to change, for it to turn into gratitude?
That probably took me about a year
right.
afterwards to get to that stage. Lots of hard work from the therapists and psychologists and stuff. God love them. But yeah, I think I started to realize, oh, you know what, you're alive and you're healthy and you're really, really lucky to be here. So let's make the very most out of it. And I think that, like, has really given me a lot of energy and motivation to push myself. I think in, like, regardless of rugby world, I get a lot of imposter syndrome when it comes to research for some reason. So it's nice that I have this new mindset, because when people give me opportunities of, oh, would you mind coming to Monaco and talking about this? Or do you mind coming into Melbourne Storm and telling us about your tackle research? I have a new mindset of, yeah, sure, no problem. I'll say yes. Like,
as opposed to in the past, you might have turned it down.
Oh, gosh, I'm not good enough to do that. Or,
really?
Yeah. Or I would have used the rugby excuse of, oh, yeah, sorry, I'm
playing.
Training. Yeah. Yeah.
That's very interesting. So this, in a way, the gratitude that you felt as a result of your recovery and being alive helped you deal with imposter syndrome that you would have felt prior to it.
Yeah, I don't know if it's imposter syndrome, but I think I've just got this new mentality of, like, I'm going to embrace every opportunity
right.
that comes along, and so what if I muck it up or if I underperform, because, you know, it's doesn't really matter in the grand scheme of things. What really matters is that we're here and healthy and you've got your family around you. So that's the way I look at it.
It's an amazing outlook. And I do wonder as well, the psychological aspect of it is fascinating. When it comes to the physical aspect of that 1 year as well, you're also battling with the fact that you're not, I guess, allowed to do the things that you used to do. And as somebody who's played the top level of her sport in her country, does that come with an extra frustration, given your body's been the thing that you prided yourself on, and being able to physically compete has been the thing that you prided yourself on, and all of a sudden a large part of that is robbed?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think I fell into the trap of my sole identity was Catherine Dane, Irish rugby player. And when that's suddenly taken out from underneath you, you think, God, who am I now? You know, you start to, like, really undervalue yourself. So when it came to the physical recovery, I was back to rock bottom I'd lost a lot of weight, kind of lost a lot of muscle mass. So really had to start from the very beginning. And it's a challenge too for physios and clinicians, because they've never really seen this happen to a young person before. It's quite rare that it would happen. So,
and would it be rarer for a high performance athlete to suffer this, or is it completely random in the younger cohort of individuals?
I think it is quite random, but right. sometimes the nature of high intensity sport may predispose an elite athlete to these events. It doesn't necessarily differentiate, but there's more triggers in elite sport, I suppose, to set off these events. But so I was definitely starting from scratch, and it was kind of a, where are we going to go with this? And a lot of problem solving in the early days and tough decisions to be made. So it was a long, long process, and I did find it difficult to be patient at times. Me being a physio, like, I should know better, but often we're the worst patients in the world.
I can imagine. I'd say quite possibly the worst patients in the world. It's fascinating, the thing you just said there about your identity being wrapped up in rugby for a while. Do you notice that with some of your teammates that maybe if you take the World Cup non-qualification, for example, the disappointment that comes from that, because your identity is wrapped up so much in being a rugby player, is the disappointment just way more? Does it just kind of have a devastating impact on how you feel as a human being for a prolonged period of time?
Totally. We put so much pressure on ourselves that, like, if we don't make it to this World Cup, everything that we've done in the 3-4 years preceding this has been a waste of time. And because we put our value on our identity being an international rugby player, we then think that other people perceive us as that as well. So they kind of look down on us as, oh, you know, failures, or you're that group that didn't make it to the World Cup, which is, you know, I think until you're outside of that bubble, that's when you see it. But when you're in it, you think, yeah, that's who I am. That's how everybody else is judging me. We're judging ourselves on that, and everybody else is judging us on that standard.
Maybe it's different strokes for different folks and all of that sort of thing. But I do wonder if there is, like, when people tap into that identity, it's kind of seen as a positive in some sporting setups, where it's like, you know, this is me. If I don't perform today, it's a stain on my reputation. It's a stain on us as individuals. And people tap into that a little bit too much in sport. Or do you think it is different for each person, that maybe you might have a better performance if you realise that, no, my identity is not wrapped up in this game. I am, whatever I do outside of rugby, I am also that person, and this is not going to define who I am. Whereas for other people, it might actually be better for them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, that's really interesting you say that, because I've noticed, especially with Irish men's rugby, that they're starting to show a lot more of Andy Farrell and his kids and, you know, all the players and their kids and stuff. And these players are dads, and that they're also, they've got side hustles, or they've got businesses and stuff as well, and they've got family. So I think it is important that the media and stuff showcase that, yeah, these people are more than just the athlete that you see. And I think in the past, there's been a lot of pressure on, oh, that player's not on form, or they're not performing well, or, you know, X, Y, and Z, and they're not, you know, maybe they're not going to get selected and those sort of things. I think that was the old narrative. I think things are improving now, and we are starting to look at the whole player, and that they are more than just their physical attributes. They have a personality, and they've got families, and they've got all sorts of other things going on. We've got the likes of you know, Sam Monaghan's and Nicole Fowley's that are big personalities, and I think thanks to, like, TikTok and some of the memes and things, you can see that a bit more, and maybe people are less likely to just judge them on their performance.
It's a really good point. Like, I was sitting in the press conference after the defeat to England in Twickenham this year in the Men's Six Nations, and there's always this kind of weird tone in the press conference where, like, Andy Farrell and Peter Mahoney come in, and it's like, it's almost like a funeral, where it's like, oh, it's almost like we can't be asking about the game, but obviously you ask about the game. And somebody asked about Andy Farrell and his grandson, and him wearing an England jersey, and it was quite a funny exchange. And it's like, oh, actually there's a real life thing out here, and actually the sport isn't all that important at all.
Yeah.
And I think bringing up Andy Farrell is just such a great exemplar of this, where he's been one of the greatest Irish head coaches that rugby has had. But at the same time, he also manages to put it into perspective better than a lot of other coaches would do as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, like, when you bring up his kids, like, the game of rugby is a lot more than just the World Cup and the Six Nations. Like, there's the opportunities and the brilliant experiences that the game of rugby brings to young kids and women and people in the sport is huge. You know, there's roles for everybody in rugby, and I think we get sometimes a little bit too fixated on World Cup qualifying and
right,
wages and those sort of things, when actually, like, it's a beautiful game that can bring a lot of joy to a lot of people.
So rugby player Catherine Dane is only part of your identity. However, just on that part of your identity, where is she right now in terms of the rugby player?
Yeah, so rugby player Catherine is in the end stages of her return to contact. She's putting her PhD research into practice and trying to make sure that she's best prepared for the match demands for contact. I was hoping to make a return, this month, but because of the trip to Monaco and Sydney and Melbourne, it's kind of delayed things by a little bit, but I'd be very, very hopeful to be putting on an Ulster jersey this summer, hopefully.
Brilliant. Have you gone into contact? So when you talk, okay, so when was the first time you took a tackle or performed a tackle since?
I suppose it'd be a month ago now.
Right, how did that feel?
It felt great.
Right.
It felt great. I had a little bit of apprehension in at the back of my mind that, oh, hope I'll be okay. But as soon as it happened, it was like duck to water. Just loved it.
It's they often say it is kind of like the first few motions when people come back from any sort of injury. It's just you're not really sure if like the leg will hold up or whatever it may be. So your experience has obviously been much more severe than any of the classic sports injuries. But it sounds like that first tackle and being a duck to water, it's kind of as quick as any other injury. I don't want to downplay it, obviously, yeah, but it sounds like it.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I had the ACL injury to try and navigate, yes, as well, because that rehab got cut short. But yeah, it's like ACLs, like that first goose step or sidestep that you do against somebody. You know, you'd be thinking, oof, can my knee hold up? But I knew, because of the kind of length of time and the coordination of the process, I knew I was definitely like ready. I had all the physical work done, all the mileage done, so body was good. Just had to get down and do it.
So back in with Ulster soon, hopefully.
Yeah.
Do you see yourself wearing an Ireland shirt in the future?
I'd love to. I'd absolutely love to. But I definitely won't be putting pressure on myself to do that. Definitely just going to enjoy the rugby that I've got. Get back into a Belvo jersey as well. And if the Ireland jersey comes around, that would be absolutely amazing.
You've also dipped your toe into the coaching world.
That's right.
Can you talk us through this a little bit?
Yes. So being that kind of type A athlete, I needed to do loads of different things whenever I was recovering from the stroke. So I thought, oh, a bit of coaching would be good. I can kind of keep myself in rugby world a little bit, but not overcommit to playing. And the IRFU were brilliant and were like, yeah, we'll get you onto a coaching course and get the ball rolling on that. And then I found myself on the coaching panel with the Ulster women's team last summer. So things progressed very, very quickly. And it's actually been a really brilliant tool. I think it'll help with my playing game as well. But the knowledge that I've gained in coaching world has been huge.
Your experience has mostly been as a skills coach, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, yeah.
I presume what you're doing in terms of your PhD, just it's a perfect marriage of your interests in that coaching role then.
Absolutely, huge. I've been doing video analysis as part of my PhD research as well, and kind of studying the technical characteristics that women use to tackle, and having that coaching background and having my connections of a coaching network has really helped in maximising the benefit and impact of that research, hopefully.
I had often seen a skills coach as passing and kicking, not tackling, but obviously that's not the case.
Oh yeah, in today's game, a lot of teams have contact coaches. There are like kicking coaches and passing coaches and stuff as well, but in the women's game anyway, the skills coach typically has to double up and do all the wide range of skills. So given it's the most common contact event and kind of the game event that carries the greatest risk of injury, it's a really key area of the game that hopefully contact coaches will be getting the same remuneration for it.
Yeah. Did you find that itch was scratched then when you weren't allowed to play any rugby and you were doing a bit of coaching? Did you find that you really got the feeling that, you know, I'm involved in something, I'm getting the buzz of match day or whatever the situation would be from that? Like, did it fill the void, I guess?
It's not quite the same as playing. I had this absolute urge to get on the pitch whenever I was coaching with Ulster. But it definitely gives you a different kind of high. I'd never been nervous for a rugby match ever before. And being a coach, I was the most nervous I've ever been. It was
so
weird. I don't know what it was. It was kind of like, I can't control what goes on here. Whereas as a scrum half and being a player, you feel like a little bit, oh, I can actually make a difference a little bit in this game. Whereas when you're a coach, you know, it's up to the players then, and you've no control. You can make a few subs and things, but so it's all up to them.
The scrum half is the control freak in the team, is what I'm hearing here.
Yeah.
When it comes to Ireland then, and this year's Women's Six Nations, just to wrap up, the performance against France seemed to be a lot of positivity around that, certainly when it came to the defensive performance of the game against France. Obviously, the second game against Italy was so disappointing given the result and some of the errors in the game as well. Third place is it's not impossible at this stage, but it obviously puts a lot of pressure on this weekend, and it puts a lot of pressure on the last weekend in particular against Scotland. What's the general feeling when you're watching them at the moment in terms of where the trajectory of the team is going?
I think they're definitely going in the right direction. I was really, really proud and pleased to see how strong their defence was. It seems very coherent, and like they're a tough team to break down. I was also really enthused by their attack, some of the offloads and the tip-ons and kicking play that we haven't really seen in the previous years has really started to come out, and the basic skills are definitely improving. I know there's lots of like unforced errors and things in the last game against Italy, but it's good to see them trying things and with time, that like they're a young team, it'll come together and it's nice that they're still having a crack and throwing the ball around. Shue.
Are things fixed? Do you get the sense from talking to teammates? Or is there still a lot of work that needs to be done behind the scenes in terms of the supports that are available to this team? Or do you feel now it's actually just making up for lost time with the tools that they have available to them now? Is there still a lot of work that needs to be done?
Yeah, I reckon looking at the bigger picture and looking at the domestic leagues and everything else, it all kind of needs to start to come together a little bit better. The talent that we have is really, really good. It's just making sure that we've got the right structures and pathways in place to capitalise on that talent.
What's missing with regards to those structures and pathways?
Ooh. I don't know. If I knew the answer, I could make a lot of money. What do I think is missing? I think I'd like to see more girls playing more rugby throughout the season. I think there's a lot of different competitions on, and it's great, but it just means that, like, for example, Belvedere had like 10 plus players missing for the season because of Celtic Challenge and international selection and stuff. So it means some of the club teams are really losing out on some of their talented players, and I would worry that it would kind of affect the standards of the club game. Hopefully not, but we'll see by the AAL finals to be able to back that up. But I think if we can find a little bit of a better structure in terms of the club game and the interprovincial game and the Celtic Challenge and the international game, if that can be married together in a way.
Right.
I mean, the men's game doesn't really have that problem so much. Like it seems to be a bit more succinct.
Yeah, it certainly does. This weekend then, prediction for Ireland against Wales?
I think it'll be close, but I definitely think Ireland will win. I'm predicting 25-15.
Very good for Ireland.
Yep.
Very good. Catherine Dane, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for popping into the studio. When does the PhD finish up? Is it one of these things that's going to take you for the next few years, or will you be free from it at a soon date?
I wish. No, my 4 years is coming to a close this summer. Right. So finishing up.
Right, you're up against it, so over the next few months to get that in. And looking forward to seeing you back in the Ulster colours as well. And very best of luck with that recovery and the return to rugby. Catherine Dane, Irish rugby player, thanks a million for coming in.
Thanks, Owen.
Rugby on Off the Ball.